Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
You know, farm bills are five-year bills for a reason.
Kansas Representative, member of the House Ag Committee, Tracy Mann.
5 years is long enough to provide some certainty, but short enough to adjust and adapt and change with the times. And certainly you look at where agriculture is at in 2018 versus today, the biggest difference on production agriculture side is where input costs are. And you can't dramatically increase our input costs and think that the farm safety net is where it ought to be. And so I've been to the floor of the House, I think 34, 35 times now, urging Congress to get serious, get motivated to get a five-year farm bill locked in place. These year-long extensions, sometimes 2 months, but year-long extensions do not provide the certainty that our ag producers and their lenders need as they work to feed, fuel, and clothe the world.
This is Agriculture Today.
So now the rubber meets the road, or the piper needs to be paid, or whatever metaphor you want to use.
Texas Republican Representative Chip Roy.
We cannot have our cake and eat it too. You can't run around and beat up the CBO and blame the CBO and say they never score anything right. Well, you know what? You're probably correct. They're human beings. And maybe they're biased. Fine. Okay. You think they're biased? Great. Come in with your models. Come in with somebody else's models and show me how the math is going to work out that if we do all of these tax cuts and do no spending cuts, that somehow we're magically going to have deficits going down. Because it's just not going to be true in the aggregate. When Ronald Reagan cut taxes in 1981, from the confiscatory top rate of 70% under Jimmy Carter to 28% on the top marginal rate, yeah, there was a lot of good economic growth. When we cut corporate rates 8 years ago from 35% to 21%, and corporations aren't these blobs, they're people. When we cut the corporate rates, yeah, there was pretty significant economic growth. That was pretty meaningful. Trying to keep more capital here. Expensing, research and development, all these things create growth. But a lot of tax cuts don't. Take the child tax credits. I get how child tax credits can be argued to be good policy, pro-family policy, good for hardworking families that have kids. There are a lot of arguments for child tax credits. But they're not going to be massively stimulative. They cost about $800 billion over 10 years. So my point is over here, it's like, what are you cutting? What are we cutting? Because we can't continue to rack up deficits.
While it's important to tell the story, however, Neil Caskey, CEO, National Corn Growers, says...
We're blessed that, state the obvious, you know, we all love food, right? I mean, that's a good thing. And I think it's an even better thing that people want to know more about how it's produced. And I think that that's a tremendous opportunity for all of us. I just got back from a meeting with our corn board in Nashville. And it's, you know, we're about, 2 weeks away from Super Bowl when the Chiefs are going to win their third straight Super Bowl. I'm still trying. And our, you know, our farmers always want to know, like, well, you know, what's that ad going to be? You know, how are we going to educate the public? And I always, you know, I kind of had to pause. It's like, hey, like, no one wants to be educated, right? I mean, like, you know, that's, you know, no one wants, and so it's like, hey, dial back and, you know, let's think about, you know, trying to connect at an emotional level with needs that they have. It was interesting. I was sitting back where Jerry is right over there earlier when a family, I guess, that's very active in social media and has a pretty interesting outreach program, and they're just, you know, they're just welcoming people into their lives. I mean, they're not trying to hit them over the head with messages about GMOs or vaccines or anything else. I mean, they're just, you know, letting them see that, you know, hey, we're normal folks that are, you know, working normal jobs, you know, with wrestling with normal problems. And, you know, if you got questions about how we're growing and producing this, let us know. We'll do our best to answer. And, you know, if we don't know the answer, you know, we'll point you to who they are. And so, but we had that conversation. It's like, you know, this, we don't have to attack people and educate them. I think it's just try to connect with them and help supply, you know, what they're kind of seeking to learn about the food that they eat. It's a genuine interest, and I think it's a tremendous opportunity for all of us to fill it.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Brazil. It's amazing to think about Brazil. And, you know, just back when I was at the start of the Cotton Council in the 90s into the early 2000s. So we were selling cotton to Brazil back then. Tremendous change that has occurred. Now they're our biggest competitor in the world market.
Kent Langclose is the cotton chair for USDA's World Ag Outlook Board.
So what does Brazil look like for coming year? Well, ABRAPA, that's the Brazil Cotton Producers Association, they're forecasting 5.24 million acres, 18 million bale crop. CONABI, that's roughly USDA, that's roughly the equivalent to USDA. They're projecting 4.95 million acres, a 17 million bale crop. So, and we have Gerald's forecast of 16 million bales roughly. So they'll, if, based on that, they'll actually outproduce us again. Now, real quick, what are some implications of Brazil's rise? Well, obviously, they're one of the world's most competitive agricultural exporters. Their expansion has eroded U.S. exports and market share of a number of commodities. And just China, we know, is a key market. So the past few years, I forget the exact few years, but Brazil accounted for 19% of China's agricultural imports over this period. U.S. was 16%. So they're now accounting for a bigger share of China's imports than is the U.S. Another way of looking at that is that China accounts for roughly one-third of Brazil's agricultural exports. So a lot of Brazil's rise is basically capturing the Chinese market. And certainly that's true with cotton. They're shipping a lot more cotton to China than we are these days. So one other implication truly is just that with Brazil's rise, probably the U.S. doesn't have the type of influence overall in the world market that we're accustomed to. Basically, you know, if the U.S. has a small crop, well, you know what? Brazil's got all kinds of supplies. So it's not the impact that we're used to seeing, you know. And I back, you know, this past summer when the U.S. crops started getting smaller, there was commentary that New York was not rising. Well, Brazil had all cotton that you needed. So what's no big deal. So that may be the new environment we're looking at going forward. So for the other thing I would kind of note here, I did mention zero-sum game. You know, with world consumption flat to zero-sum game, Brazil produces more, exports more, somebody's got to suffer. So that's where we're in right now. And I think the issue we have to think about is that this basic math. The WASDE, you know, we looked at U.S. consumption, domestic meal use, 1.8 million bales. That's not growing. If we're looking at 11 to 12 million bales of exports, that we can expect going forward, that means we have roughly 14 million bales of offtake every year. We've averaged 16 million bales of production, typically, and Gerald's forecast was for 16 million bales. So something's got to give. I don't think we can add 2 million bales to ending stocks year upon year upon year. It's just not sustainable. So something's got to give. Either we have to increase offtake of the U.S. or supply, our production has to come down. Something's got to give at some point. So I think that's the issue we'll be facing going forward. So for the U.S., again, it's just basic. We are export dependent, and we have to deal with Brazil going forward. So issues we have to deal with are just obviously our infrastructure, make it more efficient. Buddy talked on some of these issues. The financial situation we're looking at right now, make sure our farms are profitable, and then just the trade environment is going to be a big factor going forward.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
We're in a year of transition, perhaps. This is the last year of the Trump tax cuts that started in 2018, and a lot of those provisions expire at the end of 25.
Talking estate plans, Roger McCohen with Washburn University.
The corporate income tax rate does not. That was made permanent. There were a couple of other things that were made permanent. But on the estate tax side of things, of course, the big concern for many people is what's going to happen with the basic exclusion amount. How much can I have in net worth at the time of my death, or how much property can I give away during life and not have to pay either estate tax or gift tax? And currently that exemption is $13.99 million per individual. individual for 2025. If Congress does nothing, that drops to 5 million starting in 26 with an inflation adjustment, because that's going to be in 2011 dollars. So most of us think it's going to be about 7 million. So in essence, that exemption, that exclusion amount is going to get cut in half. And that will affect a lot of farming operations in Kansas, where the 14 million per person does not. 7 million does. And for example, you take, if we look outside of Kansas and look at the agricultural sector as a whole, we've got farm ground in Iowa that's selling for $22,000 per acre. And so, you know, a section of land at $7 million exemption, you get a problem at that type of values. And even in Kansas, you take a 5,000-acre farming operation or ranching operation at $7,000 or $8,000 per acre. Yeah, we've got issues. And so it's pretty important as to what happens. And so in light of that, what we want to do basically from an estate planning standpoint for clients is we want to maintain as much flexibility in their plans as possible. And we often do that with types of trusts. And other concerns of farmers would be asset protection. I want to have access to my assets. I don't want to tie them up while we're waiting for Congress to set the rules. So I want maximum flexibility, still want asset protection, and then I want to be able to adjust to what the new law is going to be once we know what it is.
If you need to make revisions or need a new one, he warns,
practitioners are going to be swamped and they're going to be busy and they're not going to have time to start from scratch and do a full-blown plan. So I want to do some of that legwork right now and have it sitting there. And then once I know what the rules are going to be going forward, then I've got my basic framework of a plan done. I've got the basic framework of a trust done. Then we can fund it appropriately depending upon what our goals and objectives are and what the law is going to be.
And keep an eye on what's happening in D.C.
What I'm told is that their goal is to do a big reconciliation bill and have it to the president by Memorial Day and signed by July 4. Those are rough deadlines right now. And you'll hear talk about maybe two reconciliation bills instead of one. The reason they talk reconciliation bill is because while it's easy to get a bill through the House on 51 votes, just a simple majority, you can't do that in the Senate. You have to have 60. And if you don't have 60, the only way around that to get a bill through on 51 is to do reconciliation. And it allows for limited amendments. It's a streamlined process. They can get it through quicker. And you also have to deal with what's known as the Byrd rule, which means if you have a budgetary effect, if taxes are going to be cut, then that law has to sunset within 10 years. Now, I totally disagree with that process because they take a look at static the revenues in a static sense. So, you know, loss of tax. If you increase tax, the thinking is that decreases revenue. Well, that's not necessarily true, but nevertheless, that's the rule that's in the Senate. So you want to watch that, and hopefully they tell us what the income tax as well as the estate tax rules are going to be sooner than later so that we have a window of planning opportunity.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Every industry group inside of agriculture and outside of agriculture. In fact, I happen to know that the American Trial Lawyer Association is meeting right now, and their theme of their trial lawyer conference is Tell Your Story. And so we're not alone in this desire to tell the story and to educate folks.
Brian Humphreys is CEO of the National Pork Producers Council.
And I think it's a struggle, right? Because the world is distracted. And let's be honest, what you all do in agriculture is complicated. To you, it may seem self-explanatory and easy, but to a single mom in New York City, it is incredibly complicated what you do every day on your farm. And so the goal here is to break through that noise a bit and tell your story. Absolutely. But let me take a step back and realize that every poll I have ever seen in the last 15 years says that farmers and ranchers are some of the most trusted people
Absolutely,
in the country.
Yeah.
Not trial lawyers, they're at the bottom. So for you attorneys in the room, I do apologize, but agriculture is at the top. And so I think maybe it's telling your story, but maybe it's more connecting on the emotional level with the consumers out there about who you are as individuals is perhaps more important than simply telling your story. It's about making sure that you have areas where they know they can continue to trust you. We are all parents, we are all kids, we are all grandparents, we're all in this together. And so maybe it's telling your story, maybe it's finding an emotional connection so that they continue to have that level of trust. So when you do say something about American agriculture, they continue to have that trust and belief in you that they should have in you.
Neil Kasky, CEO, National Corn Growers.
Many of our states have, you know, I guess, you know, if you're, they call them ILEAD, if you're in Illinois or in Iowa, and, just basic leadership development programs that, you know, that take volunteers that raise their hand and say, yeah, I want to contribute more to my profession. I want to do something and lead, you know, my organization. And I think that they really run incredible programs that build up leaders. They put them in situations and in scenarios where they have to solve problems, you know, that obviously, you know, whether it's, you know, related to their business or in the policy world, and they bubble them up to the national level. And so, I mean, I think that you know, we operate in a similar federated model. And so our leaders emerge from the states. And so, you know, most of our states have leadership development programs that are designed at, you know, producing advocates that know how to get the job done out in Washington, D.C., and they work.
Humphreys concludes.
At NPPC, we'll call it collaborative stealing, where we'll collaborate and steal your ideas from other groups. We're not too proud for that.
I like that.
We're a small industry, as you alluded to, and nobody has a lock on the great ideas, and we should be willing to share. And so as I look at that, and you mentioned the leadership development, I think that is absolutely correct. The other one is, to speak of advocacy, since we run advocacy organizations, you have states who have done a tremendous job at helping local leaders develop relationships, not only in their states, but at the federal level. And when an issue arises in D.C., and some of us were just talking about the Colombian issue, sometimes you need a member's cell phone number. Sometimes you need somebody in the administration's cell phone number, and it doesn't need to be staff. And so the state organizations, regardless of commodity, that have helped to develop those relationships and help those members develop those partnerships with elected officials have done volumes for all of American agriculture. And so as I look around, and I can see a number of folks in this room right here that have come up through either corn or pork or farm bureaus that have gotten involved in D.C. and gotten involved in their state capitals and have the phone numbers of either chiefs of staff or members of Congress because they've developed relationships. It's and have helped to educate those folks on what it means being involved in agriculture. And so as folks are looking for ideas, building those relationships and growing that is what has made American agriculture successful. And I would encourage any of the groups out there to continue to build on that, along with the leadership development component.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
People want to be heard. So I heard a fascinating statistic yesterday out in New York during the last election. AOC and Donald Trump, there's people out there on the same ballot, people split and voted for Donald Trump and AOC. Same voter, voted for those two people. How does somebody do that? How does somebody vote for such polarizing figures on the same ballot?
Dan Ventiker, known online as Iowa Dairy Farmer.
Their overwhelming response was, they make us feel heard. And I think that's why our page has been able to gain some traction and gain followers, is we make people feel heard. We don't make them feel stupid. We answer their questions. And we don't belittle them, because they don't know what they don't know. And so we're going to just answer their questions and educate. We get an overwhelming amount of positive comments. I know you can't read these, but a lot of comments that say, I look forward to your videos. I started drinking milk again because of you. I enjoy your posts. A big part is how relatable you are. We like that we don't feel stupid. So people want to be able to ask questions and learn where their food comes from, because people don't know. We know there's a massive disconnect between where farmers are and where consumers are and that gap in between. So we're not going to fill that by being rude to people. But we'd be lying if we pretend there's no negative. So, like I said, it took 2 weeks to find the angry vegans. We've had a more than a fair share of negative comments. So I do have, we'll see how the video comes through, and if it doesn't work, I can tell you exactly what he said. This happened back in 2021. This guy's name is Reed.
Hello, Iowa dairy cow abuser. I hope you're doing as great as the cows you exploit.
So he started off with, hello, Iowa dairy cow abuser. I hope you're doing as well as the cows you exploit. So, like, fall of 2021, when I saw that video, that was, like, one of the first vegans that, like, actually, like, came after our page and attacked. Like, I got really anxious. Like, my heart was flooded. Like, how do I reply to this guy? And essentially, we just replied with, like, he just was saying things that weren't true, and we just said, hey, here's what the truth actually is. Like, yeah, the dairy industry is the meat industry. Our cows eventually become food, and they become other resources, too. And what I learned through Facebook, and Reed's comment sections got bombarded with moms. And here's what I mean. Because cows, like I explained through that video, is that cows, you know, bulls, or whatever they go to market, whatever's not meat, there's a lot of other resources, byproducts, other than just the beef. One of those that I learned is lung surfactant. So lung surfactant from cows, from bovines, goes to the NICU to save preemie babies. So Reed's comment section on that video was flooded with moms whose babies were saved from lung surfactant. Like, I couldn't do any more good than that. Like that did more than I could ever do. For Reed to hear from a bunch of moms whose babies were saved because of cows. I don't know what Reed thought when he saw those comments, but like that's a really powerful thing that can happen when you get people to understand why cows are an important part of our entire agricultural system. So, let me go back. One more thing. The 20-60-20 rule, what I want to talk about is like, are you teachable? And I know I can't teach Reed, right? So why am I addressing him? Because you guys are at the top 20%. I don't need to convince you guys to drink milk, that animal agriculture is okay. Reed's at the bottom 20%. I can't convince him that animal agriculture is ever going to be okay, or that it's ever okay to drink milk. But we're going after that movable middle, because there's a movable middle that is teachable. And they're watching me and Reed engage. And we're going to see Reed's page grow 200 followers from that rebuttal video. We're going to see my page grow 200,000 followers and 150,000 followers on Facebook just from that one video. Because people saw his facts and my facts, and we can see where people agreed with. Because some people have said, I shouldn't address Reed, you should just ignore him. It's like, we know people want the truth, and we can see that through their support. They followed our page and not his. If we have nothing to hide, then why are we hiding? That's what's always bothered me, is if we have nothing to hide as a dairy industry, then why are you telling me to hide and just ignore him? Whoops, getting excited. Why are we ignoring him and just pretending like he doesn't exist? Because they exist, and they're real. And by ignoring them, I feel like we're giving them more traction. So let's just confront them and say we don't have anything to hide, because we don't.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Unlike what many people perceive, including myself for some time, it's not the Amazonian rainforest that are clear-cutting. This is the Cerrado. Basically, it's south and east of the rainforest. These are savannas, the mixed woodland and grassland areas. So not clear-cutting the Amazon to grow this.
Kent Langclose is the cotton chair for USDA's World Ag Outlook Board.
They also have water to spare. You know, they have more renewable water than any country in the world. That means just basically precipitation. Obviously, we think about the rainforest, but we're talking outside the rainforest, more water than any country out there. They also take land and water. They have like a quarter of all the land in the world that has at least 38 inches of rain per year, so prime production area. They're one of the few countries that has potential to really significantly expand production going forward to feed a growing population. You know, current estimates project a world population of 9 billion people. They're going to be one of the main suppliers of that population. Now, one thing to think about what it means for Brazil, they've surpassed U.S. as the largest producer among the exporting countries. 92% of their crop is dry land. Only 8% is irrigated. So that just attests to how much rainfall they get each year. And in fact, thanks to Google Translate, PI, the driest area in the country, it's the driest state in the country, it gets a third more rainfall each year than does the American Midwest. So it's incredible in production environment. And you can see here the lighter yellow, lighter orange area on that chart, that's the Cerrado. See the rainforest, the darker green, that's to the north and west of the Cerrado. So it's a vast amount of land, obviously, that's there. Roughly 40% of the country, if you will, is Cerrado, just ballparking it. But what's interesting about it is that it's not naturally very productive. It really is not. The soils are highly acidic. They're nutrient poor. It's not really a great growing environment. Plus, the lands are actually fairly fragile. So how did they achieve this? Embrapa, the Brazilian Agricultural Research Corporation. The Brazilian government established this research body similar to USDA's ARS, Agricultural Research Service, sometime back in the 70s, the 80s, I recall. I don't exactly when. But they established the Embrapa to do research and development and invest in production technologies and practices to make Brazil's agriculture more efficient. And they've done a tremendous job. Lime, deal with acidity. They're putting two tons of lime per acre right now to deal with their acidity problem. The nutrient issue, they've manipulated rhizodium, a soil bacteria, to make it more efficient at converting or fixing nitrogen to feed their legumes and other nitrogen-using crops. No-till farming, they perfected it. This is all no-till farming, this entire area is what they do. And then probably maybe the biggest change is just varieties that develop. particularly soybeans. They have a short-season soybean that they're planting in the, particularly in Mato Grosso, which is the largest production area. It cuts 2 to 3 months off of the typical life cycle of soybeans. What does that mean? Well, consider that in the Mato Grosso, which is roughly 70% of Brazil's cotton production, 85% of their cotton is a second crop following soybeans. So you don't have the competition for acreage like you see in the U.S. between soybeans and cotton or corn and cotton, because cotton's a second crop.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
The Chinese economy is the most unbalanced economy in the history of the world.
New U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent.
They are using their surpluses to fund their military machine in China. And I'm not going to try the Mandarin pronunciation for the sake of everyone in the room. But there is a phrase that is two words, military industrial. And military always comes first. So we should understand that we should have a very rigorous screening process for, as you identified, anything that could be used in AI, in quantum computing, in surveillance, in chips, that the U.S. has the lead, and we must make sure that we maintain it through smart policies such as you and I discussed.